This part of which is being brought to you by Wonder Enriched Bread and Hostess Creamed Filled Cakes.
Is it rolling, Bob?
きれいにね、ヘルシーにしてないとね、ダメよね。うん、本当に。うん、まあそれはそうだけどさ、鼻垂れてたりしたらさ、Nobody wants to come back。そこは気をつけて。ああ、ダニエルも、もうちょっとグローンアップしないとね、ぜひや、と思って。うん、うん、まあね、頑張っているんだろうけどね、ダディとママは結構大変だよ、毎日毎日コンプレン聞くのも。そうそう。
チェック、チェック、チェック。And welcome.Dicks and Jeans podcast number 717. That is one of those things that certain people say when the numbers go backwards, but I'm not going to say that now. I don't have the energy. I don't know what's happened to me, but my energy is just tanking. Like, there's less and less every day. And I know the answer to that is to get out and do stuff.You know, go for a walk, push yourself a little bit. But I'm not sleeping well. Oh, sorry, here comes another old age rant. I used to sleep, you know, up until 2 years ago, right through. It was just so easy for me. It's still easy for me to fall asleep. But I wake up, I go, oh, fuck, my neck. You know, oh, what's wrong with my neck? Sorry. Well, maybe I'm just a bit giddy. I don't know why that's funny. It's probably not. yeah. Okay. Anyway, where were we? Yeah, waking up. And then of course, the cat, you know, whatever time she wants. It's no longer 4:30 in the morning anymore. But, you know, it's dark now. So, she can carry on till maybe 5:30 or 6, but still it's always a bit too early, and I never get to sleep till midnight. So it's never quite enough. So today, for the first time ever, I went back and actually went back to bed, read a little, and then slept till 10:30, which is very unusual. And then, of course, I'll have lunch, and I always eat something heavy, leftovers, you know, from the fridge. And then I want to nap again. So today I said, no, you can't do that. Get out in that damn road trick. Fire it up. I'm just going to turn it off now. Hang on. Oh, yeah, here's the bell while I'm up here. Oh, that's no good, something touching it. There we go. A little late, but... I tried to fire up the generator, because you should be doing this all the time, and it's just... Maybe it's just too cold. Hang on, I'll try that. Oh! Oh, good. That was very close. That was very close. We got it. Oh, good. So you're going to have to put up with it. Now it's going to be even louder because I'm in the back of the van now, and that's where the generator is, right underneath where I'm sitting. But that's just a little, what do you call that? Ambience. You're in the road trick. So I said, all right, Ken, get the fuck up, man. Get off your ass. Shut off the damn TV. Go sit in the road trick for a while. And here I am. And actually, I'm using you as kind of a crutch. Because this is the only reason really to pull me out here. Talk to your listeners. Say hello. Say welcome well into 2019. I don't know. I guess I'm optimistic about the year. I don't know why I should be, but... I guess I'm neither optimistic or pessimistic. I'm neither. I'll just let's see how it unfolds. Yeah, that's it. I'm happy my generator's running. Hey, there's something. And every day, you just find, what are the good things about today? Always, always, always. Just look for the blessings. And that will carry you through anything. So there's my advice to you. I didn't really make any resolutions. I never do. I did tell myself I was going to write. Yes, I did. I sort of made a promise to myself. I think I even mentioned this to Mark. 2019, I'm giving myself this year to write that story. What I'm finding is, as I'm driving, all these little stories come back in words, in my mind, and I can picture it. But I've noticed, like, they're fuzzier and fuzzier. You know, the edges are faded. It's like a fade in and fade out. And, yeah, you know, maybe, are you sure that's right? And it's just a sign, yeah, age is creeping up fast. And it is getting harder, and therefore, if you're going to do any of this writing, it's the time, you know, because you're going to forget more and more. And I think the whole point of this is to try and hold on to something to record it. So today, I erased everything. I've got many, many starts, right, to this story. Jeez. I even have the title. But I erase them. I just delete them. No, that's not good. No, that's not good. No, that's not good. And today I started again and wrote, and it was just so stilted. It's not my natural voice, and I realize my natural voice is this, the way I'm talking to you. And I think if I'm going to tell my story, and I've narrowed it down who the listening audience is, it's down to two people. If I'm going to tell my story, just tell it, and then you can transcribe later if you think it's worthwhile. So I was even looking at things on recorders that actually take notes, and then actually, you know, there's a transcribe button or whatever. But the reviews, of course, were awful. It's, you know, it'd be too much for something to work that well. But I think that could work if I had, they say, if you have clear audio without interference, like don't run your generator when you're talking. You can get a fairly decent accuracy. They were saying 70 to 90%, and that's fine. That's just editing. You just want the framework. So that might be the way to go. Instead of me sitting at the computer typing out sentences I've constructed awkwardly, grammatically correct, of course, but just not in a natural way, just tell the story, man. Record it. Do it separate from this podcast, just separate thing. So I was, you know, asking myself, okay, do I need backpack for that, or the new, you know, replacement for the boss jock? And realized, no, I don't need all of that. All I want is something that records cleanly. This thing does, the Olympus I'm holding in my hand. Would it be easier if I just had it on my iPhone? Yeah, it might be. Well, do I need a mic for that? Oh, no. And so often, what we think is a solution to a problem is throwing money at it. Buy something. Oh, I need this. Then it'll do. Then it'll be good. I need this piece of software. I need this piece of hardware. I need this thing. And then it'll be just right. And I'm trying to avoid that. The recorder I'm holding in my hand is all I need. I don't need anything else, damn it. So, there you go. I don't know if you can call that progress or not, but it's still going on. I finished Rockin' Radio. I wrote to the author, and I'm going to write to him again, Ian Howarth. Turns out he was a teacher in the West Island of Montreal, which, of course, is where I grew up and went to school. He's only a little bit younger than me. And there's a couple of things I wanted to read out. I mean, this book was so good, and it's all about radio, you know, from the 60s and 70s and what it meant. And then, but he follows it right through to the 90s. He focuses on characters, DJs, and sort of gives their life story and what they went through and who influenced them. And, of course, the entire thing is Montreal-focused. So you're doing CJAD, CFCF, CKGM, CFOX, SHOM. And right at the end, he writes, Shom and most of the rest of the country's radio stations have been acquired by corporations who jettisoned the majority of the creative people in favor of bean counters, beholden only to shareholders. Well, isn't that true of everything? I mean, isn't that the problem we have with this fucking capitalist broken goddamn system? Maybe those words are in the wrong order, sorry. Broken fucking goddamn system, goddamn fucking broken system. The impact was swift, enormous, and predictable. By the time I left Shom, it was about as much fun as working in the Soviet Ministry of Agriculture. No disrespect to Soviet farming apparatchiks, but that's not what I signed up for. This was somebody who left radio after all that time. And you watched it. Like, there was one guy, Sterling, from Newfoundland, who owned CKGM and Shom and was into Eastern meditation and philosophy and turned it over to Pringle and those guys to say, hey, do what you want, man. And so they put on Eastern mysticism and Ravi Shankar and tapes and mystics and whole albums, and they just let it loose. And that was the heyday, and that was wonderful when it was created. Everything gradually, hey, we got to sell a few ads. You got to do something in there. And that's when I mentioned before, they did record stores or something, but not the corporate world. And then gradually he sold out and got acquired by a company in Montreal and there in Toronto, and then they sold it. And you've got these bigger and bigger and bigger parent corporations with CEOs making millions, getting rid of the people who are unnecessary, the artists, the creative ones. And that's just what's so sad, and it's a reflection of everything today. That's why this book is so important. And I think a lot of people think, well, no, that's just a book about radio in Montreal. And if you're not from Montreal, obviously it means a whole lot more to somebody who grew up with the DJs he's talking about. There's something else that came in. Another piece, I've talked about this, well, maybe peripherally on this podcast, about the computer riot at Sir George Williams when I was a student there. That university is now called Concordia because it merged with Loyola College. And I've met students who go to Concordia, younger students, and they've never heard of a computer riot. But the hall building that you would probably have some of your classes in was where it took place. Never heard of it. And then, you know, forgive me, but when I go on about not knowing Canadian history, because we know every fucking tweet Donald Trump sends out, but we don't cover Canadian history. And this is not history. I mean, this is history. This is not news. But we don't cover Canadian history well enough. I won't go too far down there, but I will read out just this little bit. I was so happy he had this in the epilogue. As an art student at Loyola College in Montreal, I grew my hair long. I grew my hair and wore bell-bottom jeans. Though still living at home, I spent more time away smoking dope and plotting the revolution on a friend's apartment couch. The student unrest in the U.S. spilled onto campuses in Canada, though the issues were different. The most infamous of all student-led activism was the so-called Sir George Williams University computer riot that began in late January of 1969 with the occupation of the university's hall building, 9th floor computer lab, until 14 days later when the administration called in the Montreal Riot Squad. Hundreds of students protested alleged racist treatment of black students by assistant professor of biology Perry Anderson. The occupation made for great national TV theater as protesting students tossed thousands of computer punch cards out the 9th floor campus windows and set fire to the computers, causing about $2 million in damage. 2 months later, 10,000 demonstrators marched through Montreal to the gates of McGill University, dubbed by the press as the McGill Francais demonstrations. They wanted the bastion of English education, which had an estimated 3% Francophone students, to be more French. So that's history. This whole thing was history. And I'm just so pleased to find it. Again, those are my Christmas gifts. Now that I've finished that, I can go on to I Have America Surrounded. But I won't leave you. I won't read you anything out of that right now. I will later. Thank you for getting me going. Honestly, just this bit of talking gave me a little bit of energy, just a little shot in the arm. Now it's nice out. I should go for a walk. It's icy. There's a good excuse. I am so afraid of falling, given the state of my imbalance, the state of my balance. It's a scary thing. But anyway, we're up. There's a little bit of a spat going on between Nap and Cap on the internet, with Gappages in there and Ken Bowl and Scarborough Dude and the person behind Nap. So maybe I'll get back to that little bit of fun. I hope nobody takes any of it seriously and thinks I really am annoyed. Of course I'm annoyed. What did you think? You think I was just joking? Jesus Christ. Yes, I want a wall across Canada. All right. Scarborough Dude. Sunny out on this Friday afternoon. It's sunny. I gotta do something. Bye for now.
Alive for you.
turn that down a little bit. I just gave you a good 8 minutes of quality podcasting, but I had forgotten to push the record button the second time, so we didn't get any of that. So I'm back. It's January 5th. I'm in Bluffers Park, and I've got in the background Jefferson Airplane from a CD I bought today called The Worst of Jefferson Airplane, because I don't have any in my collection. It was only $7.99 at Deja Vu. I decided I had to get out of the house, and, well, where do you go when you get out of the house? Well, Deja Vu is always a good bet. Now, I like to browse there and look at their DVDs. They got vinyl. And I don't like to spend $10 or more on a disc, because I know I can get so much more for that money from iTunes. But I do like to have the disc. So this one was cheaper, and this fit the bill. There was a woman there. They have one sort of listening station, an old disc player and a set of headphones. And if you're not sure if you want to buy it, you get them to open it up for you, put the disc on, and just sort of sample the tracks. Well, when I got in, there was a lady there, an old white-haired lady, sitting down. I couldn't figure what she was doing, and then realized later, oh, she's listening. And I guess she had a stack of discs, and I show up with mine after I finish browsing. I'm ready to go, but I really want to hear a sample of this one. And it looked like she looked at me and was like, you don't even think about it, buddy. I'm not going anywhere. And she had a stack, and I looked at it, one of them was world music. And she's going to have to sample every fucking song on that goddamn thing before making the decision if she is. And then I realized later, she's maybe one of these kind of different kind of ladies. Now, I know if I had been sitting there and somebody saw me, they might have thought the same thing. Look at that little fart with fucking white hair and a goatee. What the fuck is he doing here? So, anyway, I realized then and there, I don't need to sample this. Just fucking buy the thing. It's $8. You got 15 songs. What the fuck, man? Somebody to Love, White Rabbit. Come on. Plastic Fantastic Lover, you can't go wrong with that. So there, here we are. I mean, Buffers, I did take one walk around the park. I really should take another to make me feel like I've done something worthwhile today. So yeah, I think I'll do that. I think I'll take a second stroll around the park just to beef it up just a little bit. I have to get in the habit of, oh, getting going. Yesterday, as I podcast to you, was just a write-off. Today was a lot better. I had more energy. And got some things done. Got 3 meetings lined up for next week and another one. And I was very happy to find that I'm going to be meeting my good friend, the Rickster. Some of you will know as the man in the green hat. Rick Klaus, formerly of Ottawa, the Glebe. Now living out on the West Coast. Working for that very big corporation, which all of you will know. Microsoft, that is. And he's in town. We're going to get together. And I'm thrilled. I haven't seen him for a very long time. I got to know him and his family, his children, his dog, his wife, his wonderful house. And then he got this promotion. And off he went, starting a new life, which I thought was just such a gutsy thing. And he's one of those people who was destined to be successful. And anyway, I'll save that till after I've met with him, and then I'll probably talk about it then. But I'm really, I'm excited. And it's, again, it's part of this wonderful network of podcasting. I did say in the piece that you didn't hear because the record button wasn't on, and I'll repeat myself now. He and I did a few podcasts together back in the day when Mark and Bob used to do the podcast. I can't even remember the name of it now.
Canadian Podcast Buffet.
It was four Canadian podcasts, and it was, you know, bringing people in, maybe playing a little clip from a podcast, talking about them, maybe even interviewing them. Some of you might be shouting out the name, but I don't even have it. It's not even on the tip of my tongue. It's not anywhere near my head.
I just told you, just Canadian Podcast Buffet, asshole.
But it was fun. But the group, I think, reached a point when we had enough in terms of the circle of friendships. And as the community grew, there was a cohesiveness to those of us who had already met through PAB, I guess, through PodCamp. And there was some elasticity to it. But there's only so much energy you can share and draw on And it got harder and harder to bring new people in. And as the frequency and the number of podcasts increased, it was impossible to listen to them all. And so it was just, you know, I guess it's had its day. And that was a natural end to it. And I think that's something that's still true of the community now. I think it is healthy. I think there's a different mix when you talk about Anthony's gatherings in Hamilton, the Marsha McLuhan Podcaster Roundtables. That's a different mix. It's drawing in our new American friends now, members of NAP. But this is good. This is a very good thing. And it doesn't entirely overlap with PAB. And that's important. But I guess my point was there's only... You can keep enlarging things, but eventually people want to retreat back to those you're comfortable with, those where you can have meaningful conversations with, and not just like at a cocktail party where you talk 3 minutes with each person and just keep moving around at the end of it. You sort of really, you know, you can't even remember what was said, what happened, what had impact. You want real conversations, and to do that you need a tighter group, a smaller number. And it isn't meant to be exclusive. I mean, there's always a need to bring in fresh blood in any organization I belong to. Maybe that's... Mark's talking about community, and I'm thinking, I have nothing to say about community. But maybe that is the point, that communities reach a certain size where they work. They serve a lot of purposes to the individual. But after a certain point, it becomes too large. It loses the cohesiveness, it loses the intimacy, and it doesn't have, I guess, the same impact, the same value, maybe. I'm applying that to each of the groups I was in. When I was at the Canada-Japan Society, there was an inner core that would always go out for the Nijikai, the party after the party. It was tight, and it was the same people. You know, and a couple of new ones would come in, and that's great. Oh, good, somebody new, and you get to know them, and they're up for the next time. But it wasn't everybody. It's sort of the group sheds. And the same as that will happen at PodCamp Toronto. There'll be a core, and then there might be, in the old days, it used to be some people go back to a hotel room, and it would be kind of an inner circle of, you know, who you don't give that room number out to everybody, of course. It's only a few people. Same is true of PAB. And... So what's that mean? I don't know what you infer from that. Communities reach a point, and then after which they become either dysfunctional or they have to fragment and break into other groups. And we can see that already at PodCamp Toronto. When you've got the monetizers and the business people, they're already, they know each other, and they never really ever want to hang out with the amateurs, the ones who are, you know, make it quite clear that, no, we're doing this for the fun of it. And we don't particularly like you guys who are trying to make money out of this thing. So, there you go. I guess enough said. Is there anything else I need to point out? I don't think so. Maybe I'll just sort of fade out with a little bit of music and get back to you later. Is that a scratch? 27 years old, commanding his very own tank. But Blather still finds it a nice thing to do, to lie about nude in the sand. Check, check, check. Good day, and holy shit, the waves coming in at Bluffers Park, and they are splashing right up onto the rocks. It's a real wind. They've promised us rain and maybe freezing rain, ice. Man, those are huge waves right here on Lake Ontario. Not like puny Lake Erie. Joking. Come on. I just couldn't resist. The sky is kind of nice. It's in layers of clouds. You know, it doesn't... I don't, here in Scarborough, we don't see anything, but... The weather can be quite different. Out at Pearson, where my son is working, the airport, in Mississauga, other side of the city, it can be quite fierce, and nothing here. But anyway, so much for the damn weather report. It's just so meaningless and such a waste of your time and mine giving it. But, you know, it's here and now, and sometimes I have to get that out of the way. I've got my Leary book beside me. I'm going to go into that. It's come to my attention that certain people consider to be very, very smart. In fact, we're talking about some of the smartest people you will ever hear on the show hole. We're not as informed as should be, I'll put it that way, about my hero, Timothy Leary. So I'm going to have to talk a little bit about that. Timothy Leary, that would be Dr. Timothy Leary, professor of psychology at Harvard University, writer of a textbook on personality, and then later on went to Mexico, was offered some the hongos, the mushrooms, and took them and changed his life forever. But what's interesting about all that was he was already, I mean, he went into the field of psychology because it was a, you know, this is a growth industry in the 50s in America, and realized through a lot of studies they're really not making much progress with people in psychiatry, psychology. It goes on, but nothing really happens. And he wrote a book about transactional analysis, where you have to actually enter into a relationship with the patient. And, of course, all this came up later on. I mean, if you follow any of the books that were in pop culture that were coming out at that time, well, that wasn't called pop culture, but, you know, Eric Fromm and gosh, can't even remember the list of names, books that I used to read and love at a time when there's a lot of hippy-dippy stuff, I guess you might call it, in a disparaging sort of way, coming out in the 60s on new ways to look at things, you know. Excuse me. And anyway, he said, no, you've got to enter into this relationship before something could happen. And then he went to Mexico, and a fellow was with him by the name of Richard Alpert, whose father was a very high-end lawyer, a lot of money. So Richard was able to buy his own airplane and fly himself to Mexico, even when he didn't have a license. Richard Alpert is somebody now you might see on the internet as Ram Dass, a complete change in character. But anyway, he was the sidekick, and they palled up. And Timothy Leary took these mushrooms, you know, against his better judgment, thinking, oh, I don't know, could be dangerous, I could be made insane, and then realized, wow, this is just what he was looking for. This is the kind of thing that will change the brain, and the story goes on from there. Back to Harvard. Harvard gave him permission to do these psychedelic studies. And then when it became a little too popular and all the grad students were going and hanging out at Timothy Leary's house, they clamped down and said, okay, you got to put an end to this. And by then it had already, the word had got out, and people were enjoying it so much. I'm just at the point where in the book, I mean, I've read other books by him. I'm only on page 38 here. Then he licked the spoon. And that, of course, is the story of LSD and Dr. Albert Hoffman back in 1943. When he made this stuff by accident and had this most famous bicycle ride in the world on the way home. They go, well, what happened to me? So Leary was able to get, he tried the mushrooms, of course they taste foul, the very same mushrooms that we handpicked in Palenque, Mexico, gobbled down with bread and Pepsi Cola and jam. Ooh, they tasted awful, raw, but God, about as high as I've ever been. And these are the same ones Leary took, and then Sandoz was experimenting with this stuff, analyzed the compound, found out, this is something called psilocybin, and Timothy Leary was able to order on Harvard letterhead, send me some of those, would you, in the pill form? And so he had an endless supply of these pills, and then only after that, 1961, did he get his hands on some LSD. He was encouraged by Aldous Huxley, one of the great, great minds of the 20th century, People only know him for Brave New World, but he wrote so much more, and he wrote Brave New World in 1932, like way ahead of its time, and dealing with drugs and these idealized but brain-dead society. It's I've got to go back and read the book. I'm reading his follow-up book called Island, where he tries to create a utopia. But anyway, Huxley, this great mind of his day who had experimented, and of course you know him from The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell, from his drug experiences, which I have to reread, became a Bible for Tim Leary. Anyway, he met Tim Leary at Harvard and said, look, you've got to give this stuff out to the captains of industry, the politicians, the professors and doctors. You've got to give it up to all the important people in society so they can change the world. Like, that's how much he believed in it, and figured Timothy Leary is the guy to do it. So Timothy Leary started off and he went to the Beats and thought, well, here's some artists, that's a good start. Gave it to Allen Ginsberg, as you know, as the writer of Howl, famous pornographic poem, or so it was called, in 1955. He won the law case published by City Lights. Yes, you know all that, of course. Ginsberg said, whoa, that's not just for the rich and famous. That's for everybody, because every man and woman has the right to blow their minds. And so Leary was kind of caught between the two of them. And I'll leave it there. But it's just, he's just such an important person in American history. And I know, you know, it just makes me angry, the number of people, oh, yeah, that freak, that flake, that guy who did too much acid, you know. The guy who lectured with G. Gordon Liddy, one of the men who arrested him, busted him, this guy who heroically broke out of jail with the Weather Underground, if I've told you that story countless times. I mean, all this stuff is just larger than life. And the nasty part of the story is the government under those days, under Richard Nixon. Oh, geez, I forgot my coffee. Decided this drug is too dangerous. This man is too dangerous. We have to stop him at all costs. And unlike weed, LSD wasn't even illegal. It was a new drug. Nobody knew what to do with it. And, of course, they made it illegal as soon as they possibly could. I'm really pissed off at this coffee because, number one, they used to have $1 coffee at McDonald's. I can get a good coffee at Burger King for 80 cents, your senior's coffee. I asked for my dollar coffee. No, we don't do that anymore. The cheapest I could get was a small $1.25 coffee. So no respect for seniors. I won't go there anymore. It's like 45 cents. What percentage is that? From 80 cents to $1.25. It's an outrageous price to pay. And now I've forgotten it. It's cold. And no, that's not my brain under the influence of LSD jumping from topic to topic. I even went into my little bag. I'm sitting here in Bluffers Park. It's a day when I really don't have to do anything. I made a wonderful meal for my wife last night to prove that this instant pot that I bought was really worthwhile. So she always likes to have a meal ready for my son when he gets home from work around 9 o'clock. And so I made a very nice rice and chicken dish, which I had done before, but this time I spiced it up a little more, and it was perfect. It actually was perfect. Although my son claimed the rice was a little soggy. I can't please everybody all the time. My wife loved it. Now, where were we on that? The instant pot, the meal, my wife. Oh, yeah, so tonight I don't have to make supper. And I thought, gee, while I'm down here, it has been ages, like weeks since I've had a toke. And I could just have a little buzz, but I went into my little bag that I carry with me and there was nothing in it but rolling papers. And nothing rolled, and maybe I did. Maybe I could have rolled one. Maybe I had some weed with me. Oh, god damn. Now it's getting a bit late because I'm going to drive home. Yes, I know. I go off on tangents. Because if I just sit here and talk about Timothy Leary the whole time, you're going to fast forward through it. So I got to throw in stuff that you'll wish you had a fast forwarded through to show you that that's the kind of brain I have. But I guess seriously, folks, seriously. Nixon said this guy's dangerous. Really, I mean, it was political. It's like the kind of things, you know, I mean, you're going to think this is a stretch, but it was like the kind of, I guess, repression any dictatorial government has on its people. Like when somebody gets too much power, starts questioning authority. Because, I mean, Leary's mantra was think for yourself, question authority. That's more important than tune in, turn on, tune in, drop out. No, his real mantra was think for yourself, question authority. And politicians don't like to hear that. And that makes him a threat. And that's why they gave him like a 20-year sentence for weed. Excuse me. And it angers me so much. And it angers me that he's been, you know, he's just not there, that people don't care, that people don't know. And you may think, well, yeah, but all that's history. But the result of that was at least 20 years of psychiatric research for PTSD, for insanity, for depression, for anxiety, for alcoholism. All the research that they were starting to do with Leary at Harvard fucking University was shut down because the government made it illegal anywhere to get that drug. Bam, blank. It's not just the hippies on the street who want to drop acid. This is nobody can use it. No doctors, no legitimate mental institution, no psychiatric patients can have access to this until only recently. And it's now coming back and realized. Because Leary did experiments with prisoners. He would go into a prison with maybe some of his students and take acid with them and sit there and, you know, in a very unpleasant surrounding. But he'd bring in books on art and classical music and a stereo and give a lot of attention and had great, great success at the time testing whether the recidivism rate would drop down as a result of prisoners taking acid. Now, what they found was the result, the numbers did go down, but it was more probably to do with the follow-up after that. They cared for these people. They helped them get jobs. A couple even stayed at Leary's home. And it was all the support that they got as a result of volunteering for these tests that may have kept them out of prison. Okay, so that's fine. He did it with divinity students who just went bizarre. And that was kind of where the shit hit the fan. Like, half the students got placebos, half of them got real LSD. Some of them didn't know which was which. It was a blind test. The people observing didn't know who had it. And I think there was a story of one man running naked into the streets, and that they kind of blew the whistle on that experiment. All right, you're not getting any more of our divinity students here. But really, what it did was upset the status quo. People said, whoa, these people who are claiming to have these divine visions as a result of it, they were saying, wow. And really what he was doing, and I guess the whole essence and the whole point I've gone, I've done LSD, I've had this experiment, I know what it does to the brain, and it's not that it destroys it, it's that it just, it opens new channels, new pathways, you know, and I know I got to be so careful because you got doctors fucking listening to this thing. Watch what you say, but basically a new way of perceiving that we normally can't. Our brains are wired in such a way to help us just get through the day-to-day life and establish relationships and conform just enough to be able to feed yourself and your family or whatever it takes. And the other things that the brain is capable of doing, these holy religious experiments that shamans and priests in other cultures have been doing for thousands of years, that's not, hey, well, we're not really supposed to do that on a regular basis, folks. That's not supposed to be what your life is. And so for somebody to come out and say, holy shit, this thing, and from my own experience with it, wow, this is just incredible. Like, and it's not, we're not talking about just hallucinations here. Oh my God, you should have seen the fucking colors. It was like a fucking kaleidoscope, man. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about really getting into different realms of thought, different perceptions. I know I should have a passage here somewhere that describes that. I haven't highlighted there because I haven't got into this section yet. But, of course, as soon as they found out about it, the CIA got onto it and they wanted to find out, is this a truth drug? Is this a weapon we can use against people? Can we brainwash? Oh, gosh, I'm just browsing here. I guess maybe I should come back to you later, because otherwise I'll be flipping through. And for me, it's tremendously interesting. For you, it's not very interesting having somebody turn pages. Okay, hang on, all right? I think I have a pause button here. Yeah, okay, bear with me. I found a couple of passages on Leary's first trip. It was the most shattering experience of my life, he would write later. It has been 20 years since that first LSD trip with Michael Hollingshead. I have never forgotten it, nor has it been possible for me to return to the life I was leading before that session. I have never been able to take myself, my mind, or the social world quite so seriously. Since that time, I have been acutely aware that everything I perceive, everything within and around me, is a creation of my own consciousness, and that everyone lives in a neural cocoon of private reality. From that day, I have never lost the sense that I am an actor surrounded by characters, props, and sets, for the comic drama being written in my brain. Now, that may sound far out to you. It does not sound far out at all to me. He goes on to talk about sort of the games we play to get through life. Sort of the test of reality that we actually just, we create our worlds. And I think you know that's true too, right? Over time, we create a mental model of the real world that is strongly influenced by our beliefs, prejudices, and experience. And that model will differ from that of other people in far greater ways than is usually accepted. Because I listen to any one of you listening to this, I really don't know how you perceive of reality or how you will digest these words or me when we meet in person, what our interaction, we see each other, we assign a personality, we assign the things we think we know about that person, we interact in appropriate ways, usually unless you get really drunk. But like we've created that whole exchange. Should an optimistic person walk down a street, for example, they'd be inclined to register happy couples, pleasant weather, or playing children. A cynical person walking down exactly the same street may completely miss those details and see instead the homeless people and the graffiti. Sometimes I think my wife and I, that might be a good description of sometimes the way we see things. Although she says, no, you can't do that. You can't just think I see things, the dark side of things. But I do know that I do tend to see the bright side of things. The same principle applies to every aspect of life, from the mechanisms that we decide which news stories we'll pay attention to the personal qualities and others that you respond to or overlook. The result is that that the world in which we live is not an objective, distinct environment, but a model constructed in our own image. In the words of Alan Watts, now there's another hero of the 20th century, Alan Watts, note that name, the influential writer on Eastern religions, reality is only a Rorschach inkblot test. Inkblot. Okay, so Leary called these personal mental models reality tunnels. Each person lives in a different reality tunnel from everyone else and is personally responsible for constructing their own existential reality. To be truly free, it is necessary to recognize this, for, in the words of the Discordians, a difficult concept to grasp, for Discordians, whatever you believe imprisons you. Convictions create convicts, okay? Turn that one over to Adam Greatrix. This is a difficult concept to grasp, but is profoundly important in understanding both Leary and his influence. It is the concept, excuse me, that explains the postmodern move away from the rational beliefs of the 18th century Age of Enlightenment, which viewed reality as an absolute that could be understood through rational inquiry. Enlightenment thinkers assume that everyone operates in the same reality, but that Leary believed was just not true on a practical level. Concepts, relationships, and events were now relative and could only really be understood when analyzed alongside the reality tunnels that created them. Our understanding of the physical world has been fundamentally changed since Einstein, Okay. So anyway, I just wish... What do I wish? I guess I want to understand him even more. I want to bring him back into my life. I guess that means I want to do psychedelic drugs again someday. Really, that's what I'm saying. But, oh my God, only in a safe environment, and only when I know the source of that drug, where did it come from. These guys were getting it straight from the Sandoz in Switzerland, and they were getting the pure stuff, and most of the early LSD that was going around before the bikers got into the resale of the stuff, was pure. Chemists prided themselves in their underground labs of making the best possible stuff out there. When you hear about orange sunshine and these other things. Anyway, this whole world fascinates me, and it's just, I guess it's, I suppose it's almost like somebody else wanting to explore the 1920s and the music of those days, and maybe even Al Capone and the gangsters and who were these flappers and the dress of the day and so on. It's another era that we just sort of see in picture books. It's gone. And as my generation gets old and dies, all this stuff I'm ranting and raving about now is just, bam, it's just, oh, there's a, that's interesting, a little bit of history there. But there's no personal connection or relevance to it. Anyway, I tell you, it nourishes me. It really keeps me excited. It fires up my brain just reading about it. And it excites me no end. And it isn't, I mean, I don't expect anybody else to pick up this and run with it. Of course not. Why would you? You've got your own things. And it's like when I was talking about listening to stories from Sackville. I didn't have a TV in the 70s. It's the last thing I wanted, you know. If I was at home up until 1972 and moved back in for a little while in 76, I'd see whatever the folks are watching. I'd see All in the Family. I could connect to that. Wow, that was new. I did see Mary Hartman. But most of the stuff and the pop music, it just meant nothing to me, you know. And we were vagabonds in those days in the 70s and moving out to Vancouver. Nobody wanted a TV. You wanted music, you wanted drinks, you wanted dope, you wanted sex, but you didn't want a fucking television. Okay, Scarborough Dude, I guess I've done my bit here. Hope you enjoyed the Jefferson Airplane. I don't know what else I'll put on. Maybe Timothy Leary's Dead again, although I've played that already a few times on this podcast. So maybe this is a sign-off, because I could put this thing out tomorrow. Yeah, why not? Scarborough Dude! Signing out from Bluffers Park on this January 6th. I got a meeting tonight, the men's group, and I have a hard time not talking about Timothy Leary at the men's group, too. And these are people of my generation, but didn't go that route, you know? So he means nothing to them as well. Jesus, eh? I got my work cut out for me. Signing off.
Ralph, the time has come. The time has come to go out of your mind. Are you ready, Ralph? Are you ready to die and be reborn? No. No, first, you must be in a state of grace. First, you must examine yourself in this mirror of confession. What do you see there? Your personality. All your goals and your fears, your little ambitions. The chess game of your life. You have to check that, Ralph. You can't take that on a trip with you. And then that other side of you, Ralph, that dark, unconscious, all those animal impulses which you hide and keep down below. All this baggage, too, must be checked. You can't take that on the billion-year voyage to God. Are you ready? Then take this chalice, the elixir of life, the ancient cup, the holy grail, the alchemist's stone of philosophy, the holy communion, the key to immortality. Take this and drink.